Welcome to Roots of Today, the podcast where the past meets the present. With every episode, we journey through time, uncovering the lessons, parallels, and connections between historical milestones and current events to create a deeper understanding of the compelling stories and issues that shape the news. In early September 2025, President Donald Trump announced that he would deploy federal troops into several major U.S. cities to quell unrest, even if governors objected. The announcement immediately set off a wave of debate. Critics pointed to the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, a law meant to prevent the use of the army as a domestic police force. Supporters countered with the Insurrection Act of 1807, a much older law that presidents have invoked many times to justify troop deployments at home. So here's the central question for us today. Is Trump doing something unprecedented, or is he following a long, if uneasy, American tradition of presidents sending troops into the streets? To answer that, we need to dig into history, because the truth is, America has been fighting over the role of the military in domestic life since George Washington marched troops out to suppress the Whiskey Rebellion. As always, this is Alan, your host, reminding you to grab your coffee, tea, or whatever beverage you prefer as we tackle the subject at hand and show how Trump's use of military force inside our own borders is not as unheard of as most people believe. Why did Congress pass the Posse Comitatus Act in 1878? How did presidents use troops before the act became federal law? What were some examples of domestic military deployments made after it? What is the Insurrection Act, and how does it fit into the discussion? And finally, we'll delve into why Trump's order today is both familiar and uniquely controversial. After the Civil War, the South was a defeated region under military occupation. Federal troops remained to enforce Reconstruction, safeguard elections, and protect emancipated slaves from violence. To white Southerners, this was humiliation. They saw federal soldiers as an alien force propping up what they called radical governments. To former slaves, the troops were often the only protection against violent groups like the Ku Klux Klan. By the mid-1870s, political will in the North collapsed. The disputed election of 1876 led to the Compromise of 1877, and federal troops were withdrawn. Reconstruction was abandoned, and the South slipped into decades of Jim Crow. The very next year, Congress passed the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878. It prohibited the use of the Army, later extended to the Air Force, in domestic law enforcement, unless specifically authorized by Congress or the Constitution. The phrase Posse Comitatus comes from Latin, meaning power of the county. Traditionally, a sheriff could summon able-bodied men to help keep order. Congress now drew a sharp line. The federal military was not the sheriff's posse, but what did it mean? Historians disagree. Some, like legal scholar William C. Banks, professor emeritus at Syracuse University, argue the act was about civil liberties and taking a principled stand against military intrusion into civilian life. Others, like historian Eric Foner, professor emeritus of history at Columbia University, emphasized the political reality. It was part of the bargain to end Reconstruction. In practice, the act limited federal power and gave Southern states free rein to impose white supremacist rule. Regardless, from the very start, Posse Comitatus was less about a clear principle and more about a compromise, an uneasy truce between liberty, federal authority, and state autonomy. To understand why the act was passed, we need to remember how often presidents had already used troops at home. Here are some notable examples. The Whiskey Rebellion of 1794 was one of the first major tests of federal authority under the new United States Constitution. It began in western Pennsylvania, where small farmers relied heavily on distilling surplus grain into whiskey. Whiskey was not only a profitable trade good, but also functioned as a kind of currency in frontier economies where hard cash was scarce. In 1791, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton introduced an excise tax on distilled spirits to help pay down Revolutionary War debt. For frontier farmers, this was more than an economic burden. It felt like an unfair policy crafted by Eastern elites at the expense of rural communities. Resistance quickly spread, with farmers harassing tax collectors, intimidating officials, and refusing to comply. By 1794, tensions erupted into open defiance. Rebels gathered in armed bands, attacked the home of a tax inspector, and threatened wider insurrection. President George Washington, determined to assert federal authority, called up a militia force of nearly 13,000 men from several states. Washington personally rode at the head of the troops for part of the march, the only sitting president to do so, before handing command to General Henry Light Horse Harry Lee. When the militia arrived in western Pennsylvania, the rebellion collapsed with little bloodshed. Most rebels fled or submitted. Only a handful were arrested, and Washington later pardoned them. The Whiskey Rebellion demonstrated that the new federal government had both the will and the means to enforce its laws. To Hamilton, it proved the strength of centralized authority. To many farmers, it confirmed that the government favored the wealthy over ordinary citizens. In either case, it set a precedent. Dissent was tolerated, but armed resistance to federal law would not be. Washington made his point. The United States government would enforce its laws, even with the M after Washington marched troops against the Whiskey Rebels in 1794. Congress realized something important. The Constitution said the federal government could suppress insurrections, but it never spelled out exactly how. By 1807, memories of Shay's Rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellion were still fresh, and tensions with Britain and France raised fears of unrest at home. In response, Congress passed the Insurrection Act. The law gave the president broad authority to use the armed forces inside the United States to put down rebellions, enforce federal law, or protect citizens when states failed to do so. In short, it gave presidents a legal on-ramp to bring in the military domestically. Support came from both sides of the political aisle. Jeffersonian Republicans didn't like standing armies, but they feared that without quick executive power, the young republic could collapse if states lost control. Federalists supported it too, because it centralized authority in the executive branch. Presidents drew on the act repeatedly. Andrew Jackson threatened to use it in 1833 during the nullification crisis in South Carolina. Lincoln leaned on it in the Civil War. Later presidents would invoke it in labor strikes, civil rights clashes, and riots. And crucially, it's still on the books. It's the law Trump points to in 2025 as his authority to override governors and send troops into American cities. The Door Rebellion was a political uprising in Rhode Island between 1841 and 1842, sparked by demands for broader voting rights. At the time, Rhode Island still operated under its 1663 colonial charter, which restricted suffrage to property-owning white men. By the 1840s, this meant that nearly 60% of the state's free white male population, including many industrial workers and immigrants, had no vote. In response, reformers led by Thomas Wilson Door, a Harvard-educated lawyer, organized a People's Convention and drafted a new state constitution extending suffrage to all white men. This rival document was ratified in an extra-legal referendum, and in 1842, Door was declared governor by his supporters. The existing charter government, led by Governor Samuel King, refused to yield power. Both sides mobilized militias, and in May 1842, Door's forces made a failed attempt to seize a state arsenal. President John Tyler considered invoking federal power but ultimately held back, allowing Rhode Island authorities to suppress the movement. The rebellion collapsed, but its pressure forced reform. In 1843, Rhode Island adopted a new constitution that expanded voting rights, though it still excluded black men until later amendments. But the use of troop went beyond quelling local rebellions. In the antebellum era, federal troops and marshals sometimes enforced the Fugitive Slave Acts, returning escaped enslaved people to bondage. This angered many Northerners. Federal force wasn't just theoretical. It was used in city streets to uphold slavery. For abolitionists, it was a moral outrage. For Southerners, It was proof that federal power should protect property rights in human beings. Of course, the Civil War itself was the ultimate use of military power at home. Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, used troops domestically, and reshaped the balance between civil and military authority. And then, there was New York City in 1863, after the Union government imposed the first military draft during the Civil War. Working-class New Yorkers, many of them Irish immigrants, resented a system that allowed wealthier men to pay $300 to avoid service. They feared both forced conscription and the competition of freed black labor, whom they blamed for the war. What began as resistance to the draft quickly escalated into a violent race riot. Over 4 days, mobs attacked draft offices, looted stores, and burned public buildings. The worst violence was directed against African Americans. The colored orphan asylum was burned, and black men and women were lynched in the streets. With New York police overwhelmed, President Abraham Lincoln sent in federal troops, many just returned from the Battle of Gettysburg. Their presence and firepower eventually restored order, but not before more than 100 people had been killed. The draft riots revealed deep class and racial tensions in the Union during the Civil War. They also underscored the limits of civil policing in the face of mass unrest, demonstrating how quickly presidents turned to the military when local authorities faltered. The draft riots also revealed just how fragile the line between war and home front could be, and once again demonstrated how presidents were willing to use military force to crush unrest when civilian authorities proved overwhelmed. And after the war, the continued military presence in the South made clear just how blurred that line could be. The Posse Comitatus Act was meant to draw that line again, but, as we'll see, presidents didn't stop using troops, they just found new justifications. At the end of the 19th century, the industrialization of America presented new challenges and new situations ripe for social upheaval. The Pullman Strike of 1894 was one of the largest and most violent labor conflicts in U.S. history. It began when the Pullman Company, which manufactured luxury railroad cars in Chicago, cut workers' wages without reducing rents in the company-owned town where they lived. Striking workers, supported by Eugene Vibe Debs and the American Railway Union, ARU, refused to handle Pullman cars. As the strike spread, it disrupted rail traffic and mail delivery across much of the nation. Railroads responded by hiring strikebreakers and pressuring the federal government to intervene. President Grover Cleveland, citing the need to keep the mail moving and preserve interstate commerce, ordered federal troops into Chicago, despite objections from Illinois Governor John Altgeld. The arrival of troops turned tense picket lines into violent clashes. Over 2 weeks, dozens of people were killed and thousands of dollars in property were destroyed. The strike collapsed after the courts issued injunctions against union leaders, and Debs himself was jailed. The Pullman strike highlighted the growing power of industrial corporations, the willingness of the federal government to side with management, and the limits of organized labor in the Gilded Age. It also set a precedent for presidents using federal troops against their own citizens. Each time, the justification was framed in terms of commerce, federal property, or insurrection. Each time, it blurred the line the 1878 Posse Comitatus Law was meant to draw. Fast forward to the 1950s and 1960s. Presidents once again used federal troops in domestic crises, this time not against workers, but against state officials defying the Constitution. In 1957, the Little Rock School Board voted to comply with the Supreme Court's ruling in Brown v. Board of Education, 1954, and integrate Central High School. Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus resisted, calling out the National Guard to block 9 black students, the Little Rock 9, from entering. As tensions escalated, mobs gathered outside the school, and federal authority was directly challenged. President Dwight D. Eisenhower, reluctant to intervene at first, eventually federalized the Arkansas National Guard and sent in the 101st Airborne Division to escort the students. The Little Rock crisis became a defining moment in the civil rights struggle. Images of young students braving taunts and threats under military escort shocked the nation and the world. Eisenhower framed his decision not as a civil rights crusade, but as an obligation to enforce federal law and court orders. Little Rock demonstrated both the persistence of segregationist resistance and the federal government's willingness to use military power to uphold constitutional rights. It remains one of the clearest 20th century examples of troops being used domestically to enforce civil rights. There were others. In 1962, riots erupted when James Meredith attempted to enroll at the University of Mississippi. President John F. Kennedy sent federal troops to enforce his admission. A year later in Alabama, Kennedy again acted, federalizing the Alabama National Guard to ensure desegregation orders were followed. In these instances, presidents framed troop use as protecting civil rights and enforcing federal court orders, but governors and segregationists condemned it as tyranny, echoing the old language of state sovereignty. The late 1960s brought urban riots and anti-war protests. In Detroit, in 1967, after days of violence, federal troops were sent in, at the request of the governor. Nixon in 1970 even considered federal troops against campus protests, though ultimately the National Guard remained the main tool. The sight of troops and guardsmen in American streets became part of the national memory of that era, from Kent State to Watts. And it wasn't just presidents. In 1969, California Governor Ronald Reagan took matters into his own hands during the People's Park protests at UC Berkeley. After violent clashes between demonstrators and police, Reagan called in the California National Guard. Helicopters dropped tear gas. Guardsmen patrolled the campus, and the crackdown became known as Bloody Thursday. One protester was killed, and hundreds were injured. This was a state-level use of military force, not a federal deployment, so it didn't fall under the Posse Comitatus Act. But the images of troops occupying an American campus fit the same uneasy pattern. When protests boil over, leaders, whether governors or presidents, often turn to military force. In the 1990s, history decided to repeat itself. The Los Angeles riots of 1992 were sparked by the acquittal of four LAPD officers caught on video brutally beating Rodney King, an African-American motorist. The verdict, delivered despite the widely circulated footage, ignited outrage in a city already marked by deep racial inequality, poverty, and police community tensions. For 6 days, large sections of Los Angeles were engulfed in violence, arson, and looting. Over 60 people were killed, thousands were injured, and billions of dollars in property were destroyed. The scale of the unrest overwhelmed local police and the California National Guard. At the request of Governor Pete Wilson, President George H.W. Bush invoked the Insurrection Act and sent federal troops, Marines, and Army units into the city to help restore order. Their presence, alongside thousands of guardsmen, eventually brought the crisis under control. The LA riots left a lasting legacy. They highlighted the fragile state of race relations in America, the consequences of police brutality, and the willingness of the federal government to intervene with military force when urban unrest spiraled beyond civilian control. However, it is important to understand that presidential authority has its limits. Even before the Posse Comitatus Act, the Supreme Court had set a principle: civilians cannot be tried by military tribunals if civilian courts are open. In 1866, in Ex parte Milligan, the court said military power must yield to civil authority in peacetime. It was a strong statement, though one often ignored in wartime crises. There are other examples. In 1932, in Serling v. Constantin, the court ruled that even governors' emergency powers were subject to judicial review. But here's the catch. Courts rarely act in the moment. They review after the fact, which means presidents often get away with stretching the law, at least in the short term. Another important case was the 1952 Youngstown Sheet and Tube v. Sawyer decision. During the Korean War, President Truman tried to seize the steel mills to avert a strike. The Supreme Court said no. Justice Robert Jackson's famous concurrence laid out three zones of presidential power: strongest when acting with Congress, weakest when acting against Congress, and a zone of twilight when Congress is silent. That framework still shapes how we think about presidential emergency power today. It is important to remember that the Posse Comitatus Act is not the only law that deals with the use of federal troops in domestic affairs. As mentioned earlier, the other, and the one used by past presidents to ignore Posse Comitatus, and the one being used by President Trump today, is the Insurrection Act of 1807. It predates Posse Comitatus and provides broad exceptions. Presidents can use troops to suppress rebellion, enforce laws, or protect civil rights. It's been invoked many times: Lincoln in the Civil War, Eisenhower in Little Rock, Bush in Los Angeles, and Trump today. And while some pundits like to point out that the law is an old law, the Constitution is older. The age of the law is irrelevant in this case. Also, the National Guard muddies the waters. When under state control, it's not covered by Posse Comitatus. But once federalized, it is, unless, of course, the Insurrection Act is invoked. All this means the Posse Comitatus Act is not an absolute ban. It's more like a guideline, with loopholes presidents have used for nearly 150 years. As UC Berkeley Law professor John Yoo once wrote, presidential emergency power tends to expand until someone stops it. And often, no one does. Trump insists he can deploy federal troops under the Insurrection Act, even if governors resist. He frames it as restoring order and protecting citizens from chaos. Opponents argue this undermines state authority, militarizes policing, and risks eroding civilian trust. Unlike Eisenhower or Kennedy, Trump's action is not about enforcing civil rights or court orders. Unlike Bush in 1992, he lacks state consent. His order sits at the intersection of history and escalation. It has precedents, but it also pushes past them. Here's the paradox. Americans have always distrusted standing armies at home, yet presidents have repeatedly used them in times of crisis. The Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 was supposed to set a boundary, but exceptions, loopholes, and political necessity have blurred it again and again. Trump's 2025 order is not without precedent, but by acting unilaterally, against governors' wishes, and without a clear constitutional imperative like protecting civil rights, it represents one of the most controversial uses of domestic military force in American history. There is one more facet to this issue that no one is talking about, and this is important. Police work is not the same as military service. The objectives are different, the training is different, the responsibilities are different. Restoring order through martial law or curfews is not the same thing as policing. When you use soldiers to do police work, you essentially get a lot of unqualified cops that bring with them heavier firepower and no experience in civilian policing. That's a bad combination. The only reason to accept it is if the alternative is even worse. And that, in the end, is the dilemma at the heart of the Posse Comitatus Act, the Insurrection Act, and the debate we face today. That concludes this week's episode. As always, if you'd like to dive deeper, I've posted a full list of sources and further readings in the show notes at rootsoftoday.blog. If you find this podcast informative or entertaining, please like and subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen. The same goes if you tune in on YouTube. Also, if you have anything you would like to add to the conversation, or if there is a topic you would like to see covered on this show, please leave a comment. Until next time, remember this: get informed and fight to keep your political representatives accountable. Your freedom depends on it.